News, laws, and regulations are changing by the day. We get it. And at ADP, we're here to help guide you with up-to-the-minute compliance expertise so you can pay your people accurately and on time, regardless of what each new day may bring. Learn more at ADP.com.
This is your tech news briefing for Friday, November 6th. I'm Amanda Llewellyn for The Wall Street Journal. The short-form video streaming service Quibi launched in April with a star-studded lineup of shows, with big names on board like Chance the Rapper and Chrissy Teigen, and over $1 billion worth of investments from almost every major media company. Quibi positioned itself as the future of Hollywood, but in the end, it just couldn't compete in the crowded streaming video landscape. A couple of weeks ago, just 6 months after it launched, Quibi announced that it would be shutting down. Our reporter Benjamin Mullen will join us to discuss what happened after these headlines. Tech companies have been working to remove misinformation from their platforms in the confusion around the election. This is something we've been following on the show. Yesterday, Facebook took down a group on its platform called Stop the Steal, which had been organizing protests of vote counts around the country. The organizers of the group allege that the national election has been marred by widespread voter fraud. While President Trump has made the same claim, fact-checkers and news organizations have found no support for it. Stop the Steal had grown to more than 360,000 members in less than 24 hours, and removing the group is one of Facebook's most aggressive moves yet to police online activity over election results. A spokesperson for Facebook said its decision was in line with stepped-up measures the company is taking during this period. Meanwhile, Twitter suspended several accounts that were posing as U.S. news organizations to falsely and prematurely declare election results. The accounts mimicked logos and account names of the Associated Press and, in at least one instance, CNN. Some of the accounts reviewed by the journal used the same photos and similar profile names, and in some cases tweeted information in rapid succession, indicating that the activity was coordinated across the accounts. Our reporter Dustin Volt says we should be on the alert for more disinformation like this as votes are tallied and results are certified.
People on both sides of the aisle are going to be vulnerable to disinformation, trying to consume the news and looking for, you know, the possibility that their candidate might be able to either hold on to their lead or claw back from behind. And that just creates a perfect environment for any number of bad actors, whether it's a foreign government or someone who is operating alone and trying to create chaos. When people are high stress and worried and anxious about what's going to happen to the country, that's when we're all most vulnerable to this type of attack.
Also yesterday, the Justice Department filed an antitrust lawsuit that seeks to block Visa's $5.3 billion deal to acquire the fintech company Plaid, which powers money transfer apps like Venmo. The DOJ says the acquisition would eliminate the nascent but still significant competitive threat that Plaid poses to Visa, and that it would allow Visa to illegally maintain a monopoly in online debit, leading to higher prices and less innovation. Visa said the lawsuit was, quote, legally flawed, and that it would vigorously defend the deal. Plaid declined to comment. Speaking of the DOJ, officials there seized more than $1 billion worth of digital currencies this week that were associated with the online drug bazaar Silk Road. It's the largest seizure of cryptocurrency in the Justice Department's history. The bitcoins had once belonged to Silk Road's founder, but had been stolen by a hacker and left in a Bitcoin wallet untouched for years. All right, coming up after the break, the not quite rise and swift fall of Quibi. That's next.
This election, Absolute is reminding every American to prioritize voting over everything else. Yes, even drinking alcohol. So whatever you do, vote first, drink second. Remember, your vote has the power to shake or stir the election. Make it count. Absolute. Drink responsibly, vote responsibly.
Quibi launched in April as a place for quick bites of content, meant for all your in-between moments. And executives sold the service as the future of entertainment. It was supposed to revolutionize Hollywood. But at the end of October, after just 6 months in operation, Quibi was shut down. Now it's a cautionary tale for new entrants into the increasingly crowded field of streaming video. Our reporter Benjamin Mullen has been following Quibi since the beginning, and he joins me now to discuss. Ben, thanks for joining me.
Hey, Amanda. Thanks so much for having me.
So, Ben, we actually spoke with you on the podcast when Quibi first launched. Can you just remind us what this company's pitch was back then?
Yes. Their big pitch was premium short-form entertainment, movies and shows told in 5 to 10-minute chapters streamed over your phone.
And of course, a big part of that was the technology they used.
Yes. So they had this technology called Turnstile that adjusted the video horizontally and vertically, depending on the way you held your phone. And this technology, they said, was one of the keys to the service's eventual popularity.
And this was a company with a lot of hype around it. Why was there so much excitement around Quibi?
I mean, almost everyone in Hollywood bought into this idea. All of the major movie studios, including Disney, Sony, and NBC Universal, invested in the company. The company raised $1.75 billion, which is more than any startup I've ever covered in the media sector. And not only that, but there were two big personalities behind it. Jeffrey Katzenberg, the former chief of the Walt Disney Studios division, who was responsible for shepherding hits like The Lion King and The Little Mermaid. He was the founder, and the chief executive was Meg Whitman, who was a former gubernatorial candidate in California and was also the CEO of eBay and Hewlett-Packard.
So there was all this momentum, but just before Quibi was slated to launch in April, the pandemic started to take hold in the U.S. The company decided to go ahead and launch anyway. How did they think through that?
Well, when Quibi was deciding whether or not to launch, they looked at some of the success that major streaming companies were having, like Netflix, like Disney, to a certain extent, like Hulu, and saw that TV viewership was going through the roof. Streaming subscribers seemed to be increasing at a lot of these companies. And not only that, but they had a lot of fixed costs that they were going to have to continue paying regardless of what happened, whether they launched or not. So from their perspective, it was worth taking a chance on launching during the pandemic to capture that upside when either way they were going to incur costs.
Ben, you know, we know how this story ends. The company eventually was shuttered, but I wonder if you could just walk us through some of the biggest problems over the last 6 months that led to Quibi's eventual downfall.
They had a ton of problems. They had a lawsuit. This video technology company called Echo sued them over Turnstile, the technology we discussed earlier, and they've been fighting that battle in the courts for the better part of a year now. Not only that, but they didn't get the number of subscribers they were looking for. They were hoping to get around 7.4 million subscribers within the first year of the service's launch. And when they shut down, they only had about 450,000 subscribers. In addition, their ads weren't viewed by enough people. And so advertisers were pushing to renegotiate some of their deals or defer payments. And they had a lot of really high profile executives leave before and after the service launched.
And then, of course, we talked about Meg Whitman and Jeffrey Katzenberg earlier. They didn't exactly get along, did they?
Yeah, Meg Whitman and Jeffrey Katzenberg clashed before the service launched way back in 2018. Meg sent Jeffrey an email that said basically that he was treating her like an underling, that he was micromanaging employees, and that unless things improved, she might have to quit. The two eventually found common ground and continued operating the service with more responsibility for Meg, but they didn't exactly get off to a good start at the company.
So several issues, eventually they all culminated. How did Quibi make the decision to shut the company down as opposed to some other option? And was there anything else on the table?
Yeah, there was absolutely something else on the table. The company was deciding between shutting down and returning a bunch of capital to investors or pivoting to what's called a freemium model, you know, with more of an ad-supported service. Top executives ran the numbers, and they determined that the freemium pivot would have cost about $2.4 billion in the next few years, with $400 million in the next year. And so faced between the challenge of raising more money, which would have been a very difficult conversation to have with investors, or shutting the service down and giving some money back to investors, they went with the latter option.
So what happens to Quibi now?
Well, employees have been laid off, many of them. And the company is in the process of winding the service down. They're exploring selling licensing rights to some of the content, which they have, and they're hoping to get additional revenue from that. Some employees will be staying on for a little while to wind the company down. But for the most part, Quibi, in its previous incarnation, is gone.
And bigger picture here, streaming video is becoming an increasingly crowded market to sort of break into. I wonder if there are any takeaways or a moral of the story for other entrants in this game.
I think one of the biggest lessons is that there are only so many services that subscribers will pay for. You know, you have Disney Plus, you have Netflix, you have Hulu, you have HBO Max, you have Peacock. There's just so many of these things now. And a lot of the incumbents like Disney and NBC already have deep libraries of popular content that can entice subscribers. So I think one of the big lessons is that, you know, maybe consumers aren't willing to pay for something if one of the value propositions is that you can view it on your phone, which is something that most of the streaming services already offer.
Wall Street Journal reporter Ben Mullen, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks again, Amanda.
That's it for Tech News Briefing this week. Chris Zinsley is our supervising producer. Kateri Yoakum is the executive producer of Wall Street Journal Podcasts. And I'm your host, Amanda Llewellyn. If you like our show, please do rate and review us in your app store. It really does help. All right. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.